Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Catherine Brown, author of Standing in the Need, Culture, Comfort, and Coming Home After Katrina. We'll also talk with best-selling young adult author Libba Bray, whose new book is Lair of Dreams. And I'll have a few thoughts about my summer reading. Catherine Brown is a professor of anthropology at Colorado State University. With filmmaker Jenny Martin, she's the creator of the Katrina documentary Still Waiting, Life After Katrina, which followed the fortunes of the large Johnson Fernandez family in St. Bernard Parish. She continues to follow that family, and the result is a fascinating new book, Standing in the Need, Culture, Comfort, and Coming Home After Katrina. Kate, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks, Susan. Great to be here with you.
Well, it's so nice to talk with you. So tell us a bit about how you got started doing this work with this family.
Well, first of all, I wanted to understand something about how Black families in the New Orleans area really adapted to a disaster. I'd never researched a disaster before, but my experience in the French Caribbean with Afro-Creole people taught me something about the fact that there are large families that are typical and that really rely on each other so much. And so I expected that when this place I love dearly, New Orleans, was drowning from Katrina, and that the catastrophe was something that really called to me to get involved and make a contribution of some kind, that's when I applied for a National Science Foundation grant with the focus of what it would do to a large African-American family in the area, this kind of catastrophe, what kind of adaptations and coping and recovery process would take place with a family that was large. At that point, I didn't know any specific families in the New Orleans area, but that was my NSF proposal. And when the funding came through very quickly, as it does in cases of urgent research like this, I recruited a filmmaker, Jenny Martin, and someone I knew from work I had done in the French Caribbean. And so we set about looking for that large family to try to understand what was going on, how people that share these vital connections across dozens and dozens of family members, how do they cope? What happens? And so Jenny lives in Dallas, and I have family in Dallas, and we ended up finding a woman, Connie Tapato, who was in a breast cancer survivor group with a friend of Jenny's. So we asked her if she would be interested in talking to her large family who had evacuated to her in Dallas. 155 of them had evacuated to her, and this friend of Jenny's knew about that. And so Connie went back to her family and asked if they would be willing to do a documentary film. Not everybody wanted to talk face-to-face on camera at the time, but everybody was game.
Now, they're such an interesting family, and they have such deep roots. But one of the things that's very appealing to the reader of this book is the stories of the women who belong to Peachy's gang. This is a family with a lot of strong women, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. These are very strong women, and this is not unusual, as anyone who studies African-American families in the Caribbean or in the U.S. recognizes. This is a cultural pattern. Women were long involved in economic production for slaveholders and plantation life, and so their history is quite different than white women's history in the Western world. And we see the legacies of that in this family. So the Peachy Gang is comprised of women who are amazingly strong. They not only have jobs and have had worked alongside men in the family for all the generations that anybody can recall all the way back, they also are the storytellers. I think of them as the social glue for the entire family network. They are the ones that train children how to understand who their relatives are. So they are incredibly strong and very active, important, vital parts of what makes this large family hold together and bear up under the dire circumstances at Katrina.
And I love that they have such loyalty to place and that they tell you right up front, you know, we're not from New Orleans. We're from St. Bernard Parish.
Right. And that was a lesson that I had to learn after hearing it twice. I finally realized New Orleans is not the name of all places that
right.
may lie adjacent to the city. They are from St. Bernard Parish, and they're very proud of their history there. They have deep roots that go back before the Civil War, during slavery. And through that time, there were so many strong figures and so many ways that people connected with living off the land. And still today, the bayou environment is vital to how they live and how they understand their sense of belonging. And I think that's part of what makes it so interesting and a little bit different story than the city story.
Right. Now, you followed them through exile in Dallas and homecoming to their hometowns of Violet and Ferret, and also rebuilding. And Standing in the Need, the title for this book, is such a familiar phrase from that old gospel song, Standing in the Need of Prayer. And evacuees and Katrina survivors stood in the need of everything at that time. So in so much of this book, you're focusing on the human need for comfort.
Well, I think that this is one of those ideas that needs to be understood a little bit more carefully and intimately, because comfort is something that people think of so often in individual terms, but I think we need to think of it more in collective terms. And this family really taught me about how comfort works in a collective sense. You know, in Dallas, I could see what really brought them comfort was being together in Connie's big backyard. What brought them comfort was cooking together in that big kitchen and eating together and circulating as multi-generations of this huge family would circulate stories and updates about each other's particular circumstances back home. You know, when was the gas going to be turned on? When would the electricity come back? When would they be allowed to go back and visit? And so the constant circulation of information is something I saw over time, that circulation was vital, because it's not just about gathering, which was important. That is one aspect of comfort, just being in each other's company. But in the process of gathering together, there was also something else that was happening, and it was the recognition that there were things getting renewed. The food that was home-cooked food that is at the centerpiece of these gatherings has a special role because people have invested labor to produce it. And so there's a kind of beautiful exchange, an offering to the group, and everybody contributes something. And so there's a kind of really deep, profound renewal of these ties. Those are sources of comfort. So gathering, mm-hmm. cooking, belonging, realizing as a child that you have all kinds of adults around you all the time, and you always belong. You are always invited. All of those things bring comfort. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, the bottom line is comfort is culturally inscribed. This is something that happens at a level that is beyond the individual. And that's something I think that we just don't understand very well in the process of recovery.
Yeah. Now, you're an anthropologist and you study people and you study how they change. And you've watched these people change and grow over 9 years and live their lives, weddings, funerals, family reunions, things like that. But what was the take home for you personally? How did this change you as a person?
It really did change me as a person, because I came to see a couple of things. I think one is it changed my heart. It helped me realize that my work had to move out of the academic closet, so to speak, to try to raise the voices of people who deserve better than they got. So I think the first obligation is really ours as researchers to make public what we do and what we understand, so that there is a fighting chance to fold that into revised policy. And I think the other big thing that happened to me through this research is that I came to appreciate the power of African American cultural life and family life and the importance of food in ways that are deeply about vitality and strength, and the power of connection with people, and the power ultimately of belonging, of realizing that we have, I think, in our society, lost sight of what is most meaningful about being human, and that is that what we really, really need more of is a sense of belonging that gets nurtured and revitalized in every gathering that they have.
And that's what we'll be celebrating this Katrina anniversary, you know, love of home always. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, a special place.
Yeah. We've been talking with Catherine Brown, author of Standing in the Need, Culture, Comfort, and Coming Home After Katrina. You can meet her Thursday, August 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan.
There's a feeling you get living here from the
Libba Bray is an award-winning, best-selling author of books for young adults and teens, and these books are so good that adults should be reading them too. Beauty Queens and the Diviners were New York Times bestsellers, and Going Bovine won the prestigious Michael L. Prince Award. And I will always love Libba because you can find her on YouTube doing an interview in a cow suit for that book. She's also the author of the critically acclaimed Gemma Boyle trilogy, which began with A Great and Terrible Beauty. Libba is speaking to us from her home in Brooklyn about the most recent novel in the Diviner series, Lair of Dreams. Libba Bray, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh my gosh, thank you, and thank you for that introduction. You made me sound so fancy and slightly unhinged, which is really how I'd like to be introduced.
That's lovely. Now, I spent a whole weekend reading The Diviners about young Evie O'Neill, who's gone to live with her uncle in New York City in 1926 in the Museum of American Folklore, Superstition, and the Occult. She is just an amazing character.
Well, thank you very much for that.
How did she come to you?
Well, you know, I mean, that's always the question when you're creating something. But I can say that many years ago, I was visiting my grandmother in Atlanta, and I was going through a whole bunch of photographs that she had in a box. She, you know, was at that stage where she was going to move into a retirement place, and she wanted me to go through and take whatever I wanted. And I came across this photograph because my grandmother, of course, lived through the 1920s, and so there was this photograph from around 1925, 26. And it was my grandmother standing next to a woman I did not know, this blonde woman who was staring at the camera like, you and what army, pal? And I thought, oh, there is some story there. I really want to know who this woman is. And I said, who is that? And my grandmother said, oh, that's Evangeline. And I think she said something like she was hot to trot, or she was, you know, she was a mess or something like that. And I thought, oh, I definitely want to know about this person. And I didn't know anything else about her except that I thought, someday I'm going to have a character who is going to be this sort of wild Dorothy Parker, Zelda Fitzgerald type, and I'll name her Evangeline.
Oh, perfect. So after battling true evil in The Diviners, in the sequel, Lair of Dreams, Evie has achieved that dream of New York stardom, and she's become America's sweetheart with a radio show all her own and masses of followers and fans. Now, that is a wonderful image. I mean, early days of radio, everybody's very excited about this supernatural encounter. That must have been a lot of fun to write.
It was delightful to write. Before I started writing novels, I was actually a playwright. So anytime I get to do some sort of dialogue or theater scene, it's just an absolute hoot for me. And it was so fun. I had gone to the Paley Center in New York, which is the Museum of Radio, Television, and Film, and I had listened to old radio. And, of course, radio was really just starting in 1926. Like, it's starting to gain steam. So it was very fun to be listening to all of these old radio programs and think, all right, if I had this supernatural radio show with this kind of firecracker of a girl, what would it be like? And it was delightful to be able to bring that to the page.
But underneath all this brightness and comedy and charm, there's a terrible sickness that's spreading across New York like wildfire, and the Diviners have to find a way to help. So tell us about that dark underside of the book.
You know, one of the things that's so fascinating about the 1920s is that it seems like an era that came out of central casting. It's very vibrant. It's very cinematic. But it's a time of great change, and I think whenever there's a time of great change, you also have a lot of conflict that's going on. And so what I think a lot of people don't realize is that the 1920s was also a time of, you know, terrible xenophobia and racism, and there was the rise of kind of a stripe of evangelicalism that I think was a harbinger for intolerance. There was a lot going on at that time that provides a great contrast to this sort of party atmosphere. And of course, we know from history that it's all heading toward this tremendous crash. One of the things that I sort of like about dealing with genre, with fantasy or science fiction, and in this case also with history, is that it provides a lens through which we can also view current times. And that was very much the impetus for writing The Diviners, too, was to sort of explore where we are now and to see how all of these things are related. History repeats. It's the mistakes of the past are always with us unless we choose to really look at them. And so there was also a great deal of anti-immigration fervor happening in the 1920s, which, of course, now we're in an election cycle, and we see that being played out again and again. So these conversations continue.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things I love about these books, is that they are such long and satisfying examinations of city life and American life and change. They dramatize that so beautifully. But on the supernatural level, a lot of the novel takes place in the dream world.
Yes, it does. I think that dreams are fascinating, of course, not only from a psychological standpoint, but just creatively. It's a great world to be able to walk into. And there's so much, too, about the American dream and what we value and what we aspire to and what these characters really want. It's a place where their hearts are sort of laid bare because they are vulnerable. So that was also a great deal of fun, was to create this landscape that feels a little like Salvador Dali at times, that it's this sort of surreal and beautiful and magical place in which all sorts of things are possible, but all sorts of dangers are also possible.
And it's so seductive that many people are falling prey to sleeping sickness.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think when we talk about things that are terrifying, you know, we all have to sleep. So the idea that you can be prey for some sort of big bad in your sleep is really, really terrifying. I mean, there's a reason Nightmare on Elm Street 1 through 487 works. It's because that's terrifying. So, yeah, I mean, to me, and I am such a horror buff, and I grew up reading Stephen King, and and I watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer and The X-Files, and I jokingly refer to this as The X-Files with flappers, but, like, give me a big bad, and I'm a happy girl. So it was just pure joy to be able to be like, how will I scare people today? Ha, 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 I eat your hearts on toast. But I always use the right fork.
Well,
I'm a lady.
Be warned, readers.
Sleep with one eye open.
Yes, exactly.
No, the other eye.
Now, you've got a lot of Louisiana stories in this book, too, and there are some real ties to New Orleans in Lair of Dreams.
Absolutely. Henry, who is in many ways one of the characters whose story is of primary importance in this particular book, is a piano player, and he is from New Orleans. I love New Orleans. Having grown up in Texas, one of my favorite things to do was to, especially in college, was to just hop in a car with a friend and drive from Austin to New Orleans and go spend a weekend and then drive back and be pretty exhausted. But I think that New Orleans is, I would have to say that outside of New York, I mean, it's certainly in my top five favorite American cities, and I think that there's just no place like it. So to have a character from New Orleans, to be able to dive into the history of, you know, what the quarter was like and what it was like also for LGBTQ people at that time, was really fascinating reading, and I can't wait to be in New Orleans.
Well, I have to warn you that those college trips are the way most of us, a lot of us, got started here. So. Come for a weekend, stay for life.
Speaking of seductive pools, the food alone.
Yeah. Now, listen, I'm very curious to know, these books are both so long. They're well over 600 pages, and so much of the subject matter is adult. Do you ever strain against the classification of your books? I mean, these are perfectly valid adult books and works of mainstream fiction. They're really beautiful to read and thrilling and kind of utterly enveloping. So do you have that sense of them as adult books when you're writing them, or are you thinking about writing for young people?
That's a great question. I tend to write without classification. I feel like I'm writing the story that I'm going to write. These are decidedly sort of 19th century model novels. They take their time, and it does demand a certain amount of attention from the reader. I mean, I hope that there are enough thrills and enough heart to keep people reading. And so that, I think, tends to be something that is a challenge across any readership, whether it's adult or young adult. I do think that it kind of strains at what we now think of as the model for young adult. But teenagers are not monolithic. And if it's not for them, they'll put it down. But I certainly hear from plenty of teenagers who will say, oh, man, that was like mad scary, you know. So I do think that it's somewhat of a challenging read, but I don't think that it is something that teenagers can't or won't be interested in.
Well, I certainly wasn't channeling my inner teenager when I was reading this book, but it was so much fun. Such a wonderful diversion.
Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. It's good to know that even though I didn't get asked to senior prom, I've gone on to lead a perfectly okay life.
Yes, you have.
I'm not bitter about that. Not at all.
We've been talking with best-selling author Libba Bray, whose amazing and expansive new novel in the Diviner series is Lair of Dreams. You can meet her Wednesday, August 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Libba, thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, thank you. This was a blast.
It's the last week in August, a time I usually look back over what I've read and thought about these long, hot summer months. This summer, that meant Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman, of course, and great and lengthy phone conversations with both my kids about it. I've fallen back in love with Shirley Jackson, best known for The Lottery, of course, and her hilarious memoirs of domestic life and strife, Life Among the Savages and Raising Demons, as well as the new anthology Let Me Tell You. I love The Book of Speculation by Erica Swiler, a wonderful story about a book come home to its family. Claire Tomlin's biography of Charles Dickens brought the master to life for me, and Nancy Prinzenthal's biography of the painter Agnes Martin was a cool distraction from blazing summer days. August is the longest month for many New Orleanians, as the 10th anniversary of the flood continues to be observed and observed and observed. It's a month of new books about New Orleans, too. Some of us will read every one, others will ignore them all, some few will collect them to read later. They make for hard but edifying reading for the most part. I have friends who tell me that every time they see or hear the K-word, they look away or hit the remote, and I understand that too. But reading about Katrina, let's just say it, has been part of my job for the past decade. Here are some of the best of this season. We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City, by the distinguished urbanist Roberta Brandes Gratz, breaks down our recovery into specific areas with a memorable chapter about the work of Women of the Storm. Gary Rivlin, in Katrina, After the Flood, looks at the recovery through the lives of people as diverse as Alden McDonald of Liberty Bank, developer Joe Cannizzaro, the Wall Sisters of New Orleans East, and many, many others. Standing in the Need, Culture, Comfort, and Coming Home After Katrina, by today's guest Kate Brown, is one of my favorites, an account of the exile and return of one large Afro-Creole family in St. Bernard Parish. And Cynthia Joyce's Please Forward, How Blogging Reconnected New Orleans After Katrina, captures vibrant and vital online writing from 2005 to 2007. Still to come in September is Wendell Pierce's wonderful memoir, The Wind in the Reeds. For a list of recommended Katrina reading, check out our page at wwno.org. Like everyone else, I find these books elicit a strong emotional response. I get angry, I grow tired. Sometimes I throw the book across the room. I feel proud, I laugh, I cry. Yes, I cry too. I don't just take these books seriously. I take them to heart because I have my own memories of 2005. And then I put all the books away and don't think about them until another August comes. And what I do think about, with pride and with pleasure, is the way our literary community has bounced back. Libraries are open again all over South Louisiana after the long struggle to rebuild. Our signature literary festivals are strong, too, and new ones have come along. Books from Louisiana writers pour in as new writers move to town and write about New Orleans. Other writers are coming of age and doing some of their best work. Indie booksellers are there to showcase writers' work to a loyal audience. New Orleans is now home to a thriving scene of book and letterpress artists as well. We're still a literary city, one of the best. I'm curious to see how folks observe this anniversary. When I mentioned to my son that I was thinking of leaving town, he said quite emphatically, "Don't do that. That's what we did 10 years ago." And the more I thought about it, the more the rightness of that sank in. So I will be enjoying a perfect New Orleans day. Maybe take the dog to the park, cook a pot of gumbo, listen to some New Orleans music, get the glitter out for Musa's shoes, and read a book by a local writer. Because one lesson we learned in 2005 was to enjoy the gifts our city gives us in such abundance. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Blaine Lord signs Born on the Bayou Tuesday, August 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, best-selling young adult novelist Libba Bray, signs Lair of Dreams Wednesday, August 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Gary Rivlin signs Katrina, After the Flood, Wednesday, August 26th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Mona Lisa Saloy, author of Second Line Home, and Fatima Sheikh, author of What Went Missing and What Got Found, read Wednesday, August 26th at 6:30 at the Will Alexander Library at Xavier University. Novelist and award-winning music writer Tom Piazza talks about his work Wednesday, August 26th at 7 at Keller Library's Author Night. John Biganay signs Rising Water, the trilogy, which includes Rising Water, Mold, and Shotgun, Thursday, August 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Carolyn Cobb, author of New Orleans Memories, One Writer's City, discusses Water, Water Everywhere, about the city's relationship with water, Thursday, August 27th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Stephanie Hepburn discusses her new book for children called Conversations with My Daughter About Human Trafficking, Thursday, August 27th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Catherine Brown, discusses and signs Standing in the Need, Culture, Comfort, and Coming Home After Katrina, Thursday, August 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Rising Tide, a conference on the future of New Orleans, holds its 10th annual gathering, Saturday, August 29th from 9 to 6 at Xavier University. Activist DeRay McKesson is the keynote speaker, and others include Cynthia Joyce, Bob Marshall, Gary Rivlin, Rebecca Thiem, and a special presentation by the Melanated Writers Collective. Check out risingtidenola.com for more information. There will be a poetry reading titled Before, During, Since, Saturday, August 29th at 2 at Ladder Library. It's hosted by Gina Ferrara and features Jerry Ward, Lee Grew, Valentine Pierce, Ralph Adamo, Jonathan Klein, and Bill Lavender. Katrina, a 10-year anniversary reading, features Tom Beller, Peter Cooley, Kay Murphy, Neo Sundari, Gian Smith, and Jessamyn Ward. It takes place Saturday, August 29th at 3 at Freeman Auditorium, Waldenburg Arts Center, Tulane University. Phil Bildner signs his children's book, Marvelous Cornelius, Hurricane Katrina and the Spirit of New Orleans, Sunday, August 30th at 2 at Octavia Books. Warmest congratulations to Peter Cooley, professor of English and head of the Creative Writing Department at Tulane, who's been selected as the new State Poet Laureate. Peter is the author of 10 poetry collections. The most recent is Night Bus to the Afterlife, published in 2014. He will serve a 2-year term. And a big shout out to Sarah M. Broom for Our Empty Plot in New Orleans, her wonderful essay in this week's New Yorker. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.